A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about settler violence in the West Bank, the recurring attacks on Palestinian villages that happen week after week without any real crackdown. His read is that this isn't ineptitude or stretched resources. It's a culture of tolerance. He wants to know how long this has been a phenomenon and what Palestinian accounts tell us about actually living through it. And honestly, this is one of those topics where the gap between official statements and what's documented on the ground is so wide, you could drive a settlement through it.
There was an incident just last month that encapsulates the whole thing. May 12th, settlers from the Havat Gilad outpost. That's an unauthorized settlement that the Israeli government has repeatedly promised to dismantle and never has. They torched about 40 olive trees and a water cistern in the village of Kusra near Nablus. And here's the detail that matters. IDF soldiers were reportedly present, watching, and did not intervene.
That's not random vandalism, that's economic warfare. Those trees take decades to mature.
And Kusra has been targeted repeatedly. In 2023, settlers from the same outpost attacked the village during the olive harvest, and soldiers again stood by. So the question isn't whether this happens. The question is why nothing stops it. And to answer the prompt properly, we need to look at how the legal and military systems actually operate in the West Bank.
Where do we start? Because I think a lot of people hear settler violence and picture, you know, some angry guy with a rock. But the term covers a lot more than that.
It covers a spectrum. On one end, you have what are called price tag operations. These are organized, ideological attacks where settlers target Palestinian property in retaliation for government actions they oppose, like evacuating an outpost. The name comes from the idea that any state action against settlements extracts a price. On the other end, you have the daily grind of intimidation. Settlers blocking roads, poisoning wells, destroying crops, attacking shepherds, firing weapons near villages. And the key thing is, this isn't spontaneous. Yesh Din, which is an Israeli human rights organization that documents this stuff meticulously, has found that a lot of these attacks are coordinated. Settlement councils are involved. There's planning.
That's the branding of domestic terrorism.
It's politically motivated violence intended to terrorize a civilian population. I'm not sure how else you'd classify it, and the legal architecture that's supposed to address this is, on paper, fairly clear. The West Bank is under Israeli military occupation. Specifically, Area C, which is about 60% of the territory, is under full Israeli military and civilian control. The IDF has the legal authority to arrest Israeli civilians who commit crimes there. They can detain settlers, they can hand them over to Israeli police. The jurisdictional framework exists.
The law is there. What happens in practice?
Yesh Din tracked data from 2005 to 2023 and found that over 90% of investigations into settler violence against Palestinians were closed without indictment. In 2023 specifically, only 1.8% of investigations led to an indictment. 1.8%. That's not a failure rate. That's a filtration system.
You've got a 98% chance of getting away with it. That's not a justice system. That's a permission structure.
Here's where the institutional design becomes clear. When a settler commits a crime against a Palestinian, the settler is tried in Israeli civilian courts, which have consistently handed down light sentences, often community service, suspended sentences. When a Palestinian commits a crime, they face military courts with conviction rates above 99%. It's a dual legal system based on ethnicity. The same act, the same location, different courts, different outcomes.
The mechanism of tolerance isn't a memo saying, let the settlers run wild. It's a legal architecture that processes settler violence into nothing.
And then there's the military dimension. B'Tselem and Breaking the Silence. Breaking the Silence is the organization of former Israeli soldiers who testify about their service. They've documented case after case where soldiers are explicitly ordered not to intervene in settler attacks. The rules of engagement for dealing with settlers are completely different from those for dealing with Palestinians. soldiers are told that settler violence is a police matter, not a military one, even though the military is the only authority present in most of these areas. So you have a situation where the people with guns and legal authority are standing there watching, because their orders say this isn't their job.
The police aren't coming because they're not deployed in Area C in any meaningful way.
There was a case in 2023. A Palestinian shepherd named Ahmad Abu Klaish from a village near Nablus. His flock was attacked by settlers from the Itamar settlement. Soldiers were there. They filmed the attack on their phones. They did nothing. The footage was later obtained by human rights groups, and it shows the soldiers standing maybe 50 meters away while settlers beat the shepherd and scatter his sheep. The IDF later said they were investigating. Nothing came of it.
Filming the crime you're supposed to prevent. That's the IDF as documentary crew.
There's another case from 2023 that's even more stark. A settler from Havat Gilad shot a Palestinian farmer. The IDF arrived and confiscated the victim's weapon, not the shooter's. The shooter kept his gun. The victim was disarmed.
The state response to a shooting is to make sure the victim can't defend himself next time. That's not a bug. That's the feature.
Let me trace the history, because the prompt asks how long this has been going on. The modern settler movement really took shape in the 1970s and 80s, and with it came organized violence. In the early 80s, there was a group called the Jewish Underground. Actual settlers who carried out bombing attacks against Palestinian mayors planned to blow up the Dome of the Rock. They were arrested, tried, and given life sentences. But they were all released early, and some of them later became prominent figures in the settlement movement. So even in the most extreme case, the state's response was ultimately lenient.
The terrorists became movement elders.
The real inflection point came in 2005, after the Gaza disengagement. That's when the Israeli government evacuated all settlements from Gaza. The settler movement was traumatized by this. They saw it as a betrayal, and the price tag doctrine emerged as a direct response. The idea was, any time the government acts against settlements, Palestinians will pay a price. It was designed to raise the political cost of any future disengagement. And it worked. No Israeli government has evacuated a significant settlement since.
The violence is strategic. It's not just hatred. It's a calculated deterrent against government action.
Then came Douma, July 31, 2015. Settlers firebombed a Palestinian home in the village of Douma while the family was sleeping. They killed 18-month-old Ali Dawabshe, his father Saad, and his mother Riham. The 4-year-old son Ahmad survived with severe burns. The Shin Bet, Israel's internal security service, they actually investigated this one seriously because the international outcry was enormous. They arrested settlers. There were indictments. And then the case just, one defendant was convicted of murder, but the sentence was relatively light given the crime. The systemic response didn't change. The outpost the attackers came from is still there.
An 18-month-old burned alive, and the system nodded and moved on. That's the data point that tells you this isn't about a few bad apples.
In 2017, the Knesset passed what's called the Regularization Law. This retroactively legalized about 4,000 settler homes built on private Palestinian land. The Israeli Supreme Court struck it down eventually, but the message was clear. The state will find ways to legitimize what settlers do. If you build on stolen land, the government will figure out a legal workaround.
The law as time machine.
This connects to the core argument. The tolerance of settler violence is not a failure of enforcement. It is a feature of a system that prioritizes settlement expansion over Palestinian safety. The violence serves a purpose. It clears land. It intimidates communities into leaving. It expands de facto Israeli control without the international consequences that would come from formal annexation.
Settler violence is the low-cost, deniable arm of annexation.
That's exactly what it is, and the numbers bear this out. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reported 1,280 settler attacks in 2023. That's a 40% increase from 2022. And in 70% of those attacks, the IDF was present. The soldiers were there, and the attacks still happened.
Presence without intervention. That's not policing, that's spectating.
Let's move to the second part of the prompt. What do Palestinian accounts tell us about living through this? Because the statistics are one thing, but the lived experience is something else.
I think this is where a lot of coverage falls short. You get the headline, settlers attack village, 3 injured, and it flattens into a data point. You don't get the texture of what it means to live with this as a constant.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Al-Haq, that's a Palestinian human rights organization, have been collecting oral histories for years. Al-Haq published a major report in 2025 called Living Under the Watch, and it's devastating. The accounts describe a pattern of unpredictability. You never know when the next attack is coming. You're farming your land, and suddenly there are masked men with weapons coming down the hill. You're walking your children to school, and a settler vehicle blocks the road and the occupants get out with clubs. The psychological toll on children is immense. Bedwetting, nightmares, refusal to leave the house. These are documented clinical effects.
The randomness is part of the terror. If it were predictable, you could plan around it.
And there's the economic dimension. When settlers burn olive groves, they're not just destroying trees, they're destroying a family's livelihood. Olive oil is a major cash crop in the West Bank. Some of these trees are centuries old. You lose a grove, you lose your income for a generation. When settlers poison wells, and this has happened repeatedly, you lose water access in an arid region. When they attack shepherds, they scatter flocks that may never be recovered. The economic devastation compounds the physical terror.
There's a village called Ain al-Hilwe, near Hebron. I read about this. Settlers from a nearby outpost have poisoned the wells 3 times since 2021. Each time, the IDF declared the area a closed military zone, which meant journalists couldn't document it, and human rights workers couldn't access the site. The closure protected the attackers, not the victims.
That's the playbook. The closed military zone designation is one of the most effective tools for preventing accountability. It's used routinely after settler attacks, ostensibly for security, but the effect is to block documentation. And the knock-on effect of all this are reshaping the political geography. Since 2020, 23 Palestinian communities in Area C have been fully abandoned due to settler violence and military restrictions. Entire villages empty. The people didn't leave because they wanted to. They left because staying became impossible.
23 communities. That's creeping ethnic cleansing by attrition.
This is what makes a two-state solution increasingly unviable. The settlement enterprise, combined with the violence that clears Palestinian land, is creating facts on the ground that make partition geographically impossible. You can't have a contiguous Palestinian state when settlements and outposts and settler-only roads have carved the West Bank into disconnected enclaves. The violence accelerates this process without the Israeli government having to formally endorse it.
The international community condemns the violence, but the violence achieves exactly what the Israeli right wants. It's win-win for them. They get the land, and they get to say we don't control these extremists.
The political economy of this is worth examining. Since 2022, Itamar Ben-Gvir has been the national security minister. This is a man who was convicted of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism before entering politics. He now oversees the police. Under his tenure, police resources have been systematically diverted away from investigating settler crime. Settler violence cases sit in files. Witnesses aren't interviewed. Evidence isn't collected. The institutional capacity to enforce the law has been deliberately degraded.
The arsonist running the fire department.
There's a case from 2025 that got some attention. A 12-year-old Palestinian girl named Layan Abu Spaya was shot in the leg while walking to school near Nablus. The shooter was a settler from a nearby outpost. He was arrested and released on bail the same day. A 12-year-old girl shot on her way to school, and the suspect is home for dinner.
What's the message that sends? To the shooter, to the girl, to the community?
The message to settlers is, you will not face consequences. The message to Palestinians is, the state will not protect you. The message to the international community is, your condemnations don't matter. And this is where the recent news connects. Just this week, there was an Al Jazeera report. June 6th, today's date, about settlers shrugging off global condemnation. The headline was, Badge of Honor, Israeli Settlers Shrug Off Global Condemnation. They quoted settlers saying that international criticism only strengthens their resolve. One settler leader said, quote, Every condemnation from Europe is a certificate of approval for us.
International pressure is counterproductive in their framework. It validates them.
There was a May 22nd report from Al Jazeera about Western nations warning Israel to end illegal settlement expansion and violence. The same cycle. condemnations, Israeli government issues a statement saying it opposes violence, nothing changes. The BBC had a piece just recently about a 14-year-old Palestinian boy shot dead by settlers in the West Bank. These aren't historical cases. These are current events. The escalation is ongoing.
The UN experts, what did they say?
There was a report, UN experts alarmed by what they called escalating settler terror and displacement in the West Bank. They used the word terror. That's significant because UN language is usually calibrated very carefully. They documented a pattern of attacks designed to force displacement, and they explicitly linked it to the expansion of settlements.
Let's pull this together. We've got a legal system that processes settler violence into near-zero consequences. We've got a military that's present for 70% of attacks and doesn't intervene. We've got a political leadership that diverts police resources away from investigating settler crime. And we've got 23 communities that have been emptied since 2020. The word tolerance undersells it. This is state-enabled demographic engineering.
This is where I want to address a few misconceptions head-on. The first is that settler violence is carried out by a tiny fringe of extremists. The data doesn't support this. When 1,280 attacks happen in a single year, when settlement councils are involved in coordination, when attacks are organized and systematic, that's not a fringe. That's a movement with institutional backing.
The few bad apples defense only works if you're talking about, you know, a few apples.
The second misconception is that the Israeli government actively opposes settler violence. Official statements do condemn it. Prime ministers have called it unacceptable. But the enforcement record tells a completely different story. Condemnation without enforcement is performance. If you say you oppose something and then systematically fail to stop it, your opposition is theater.
Words are cheap. Indictments are expensive.
The third misconception is that settler violence is a response to Palestinian attacks. The data shows that the majority of attacks target unarmed civilians, crops, and property, and they occur in areas with no recent Palestinian violence. This is not retaliation. This is aggression designed to displace people from their land.
Even if it were retaliation, which it isn't, collective punishment is a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. You don't get to burn an entire village's olive groves because someone somewhere threw a rock.
Let's talk about what this means for the broader conflict. The cumulative effect of these attacks, combined with settlement expansion, is making any negotiated settlement increasingly impossible. The two-state solution requires a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. What exists now is a patchwork of disconnected enclaves, with settlements and military zones and settler-only roads cutting between them. Every village that's abandoned, every olive grove that's burned, every well that's poisoned, it all shrinks the map of what a Palestinian state could be.
The violence is doing the work that formal annexation would do, but without triggering the international consequences.
Formal annexation would likely trigger sanctions, diplomatic isolation, possibly even UN Security Council action. But incremental, violence-driven land acquisition? The international community issues statements. The EU sanctions a few individual settlers. Not the state, not the institutions, just named individuals. The US administration's current policy is what they call no objection to natural growth of settlements, which has been interpreted as a green light. The cost-benefit calculation for the Israeli government is clear. Tolerating settler violence is politically cheap and territorially effective.
The ICC investigation. You mentioned this before. The International Criminal Court looking into settlement activity. Is that actually shifting the calculus?
It's the wild card. The ICC has been investigating Israeli actions in the West Bank, and the prosecutor has indicated that settlement expansion and related violence fall within the court's jurisdiction. But the ICC moves slowly, and Israel doesn't recognize its jurisdiction. The real question is whether the threat of arrest warrants for senior officials changes the domestic political calculation. So far, it hasn't.
What do Palestinians who live through this actually say? Let's get specific.
The Al-Haq report from 2025 collects testimony that's hard to read. One farmer from the South Hebron Hills described watching settlers set fire to his wheat field, his entire year's harvest, while soldiers stood on a nearby hill. He said, quote, "I didn't cry for the wheat. I cried because my son was watching me, and I could do nothing." That's the generational trauma. It's not just the economic loss. It's the humiliation of being unable to protect your family in front of your children.
That's the thing that doesn't make it into the news cycle. the father who has to explain to his son why the men with guns can burn their food and nobody stops them.
There's another account from a woman in the northern Jordan Valley. Settlers from a nearby outpost had been harassing her community for months, cutting water pipes, blocking the road, firing weapons at night to terrorize the children. She said the worst part wasn't the attacks themselves, it was knowing that the soldiers at the checkpoint saw everything and did nothing. She said, quote, "When the people who are supposed to protect you watch your attackers and smile, you understand your place in this world."
You understand your place in this world. That's the political education of an occupied people.
This connects to something important about how we talk about this issue. Media coverage often frames settler violence as a law and order problem. The state needs to do a better job of policing extremists. But the Palestinian accounts tell a different story. They describe a system that is working exactly as intended. The violence isn't a breakdown of order, it's a mechanism of control.
The soldiers aren't failing to do their jobs. They're doing their jobs. Their job just isn't what the official narrative says it is.
There's a concept in political science called violent pluralism. It's when a state selectively tolerates or enables non-state violence against certain populations because that violence serves state interests. It's been documented in other contexts. Paramilitaries in Colombia, militant groups in India. The pattern is the same. The state maintains deniability while the violence achieves strategic objectives. That's what we're seeing in the West Bank.
The deniability is crucial. Every time there's an international outcry, the government can say, "We condemn this, we're investigating," and then the investigation goes nowhere, and the cycle repeats.
Let me give you the numbers on that cycle. Yeshdin tracked investigations from 2005 to 2023. Over 1,700 complaints filed. 1.8% led to indictments. The rest were closed. Insufficient evidence, perpetrator unknown, no criminal intent found. These are cases where the attacks happened in broad daylight, often with soldiers present, often with video evidence. The insufficient evidence finding is a bureaucratic reflex, not a genuine assessment.
The evidence is insufficient because nobody collected it. Nobody interviewed witnesses. Nobody secured the scene. Nobody treated it as a crime.
This is where the Ben-Gavir effect is so significant. The National Security Minister controls the police. If the police aren't directed to investigate settler violence, they won't. If witnesses aren't protected, they won't come forward. If evidence isn't preserved, cases collapse. The entire chain of accountability has been deliberately broken.
Let's talk about what listeners can actually do with this information, because this can feel overwhelming. It's a systemic problem with deep historical roots and powerful institutional backing. What's the value of understanding it?
The first thing is to understand that the framing matters. When you see a news story about settler violence, pay attention to how it's framed. Is it described as a clash between settlers and Palestinians? That implies equivalence. Is it described as the work of a fringe? That obscures the systemic nature. Is the IDF described as intervening or present? Those are different things. The language of coverage often launders state complicity.
The passive voice does a lot of work in these stories. Clashes broke out, as if violence is a weather system that just happens.
The second thing is to follow the organizations that document this in real time. Yeshdin publishes regular reports with specific case data. Batella maintains a database of incidents. Breaking the Silence collects soldier testimony. These are Israeli organizations. This isn't external criticism, it's internal documentation by Israelis who are sounding the alarm.
The Palestinian organizations, Al-Haq, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, Adamir, their documentation is meticulous.
The third thing is to understand the structural nature of this. It's not about individual bad actors who need to be punished. It's about a system that was designed to produce these outcomes. Punishing individual settlers won't solve the problem if the legal and military structures that enable them remain intact.
That's the uncomfortable conclusion. The problem isn't a failure of enforcement. The problem is that the system is enforcing exactly what it was built to enforce. Jewish-Israeli control over maximum land with minimum Palestinians on it.
Which brings us to the open question. Where does this trajectory lead? The current path is toward de facto annexation. A situation where Israel controls all of the West Bank in practice, but doesn't formally declare sovereignty, avoiding the international consequences. the violence, the settlement expansion, the military restrictions, the abandoned villages. It all points in one direction.
Formal annexation is still a possibility, especially with the current Israeli government. Ben-Gavir and his allies have been explicit about wanting it. The question is whether the international response, sanctions, diplomatic isolation, ICC warrants, would be severe enough to deter it.
The 2026 U.S. administration's stance is critical here. The current policy of no objection to natural growth has been interpreted by the Israeli right as permission to accelerate settlement expansion. If that interpretation holds, the facts on the ground will become even more entrenched. If there's a policy shift, if the U.S. starts treating settlement expansion as a violation of international law with consequences, that could change the calculus.
Even a U.S. policy shift might not be enough at this point. The settlements aren't temporary outposts anymore. They're cities with hundreds of thousands of people. The infrastructure is permanent. The political constituency for maintaining them is powerful within Israel. Reversing this would require a political transformation that's hard to imagine from here.
I think about the Kusra olive trees from the opening. 40 trees, some of them probably older than the state of Israel, burned in an afternoon, and the soldiers watched. That's a small tragedy, a few dozen trees, a water cistern, but it's also the whole story in miniature. The violence, the impunity, the watching, the loss, the accumulation of small tragedies that add up to something irreversible.
The olive tree is a political metaphor. It takes decades to grow. It sustains a family. It roots people to their land. And it burns in an hour.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, a Kiribati fisherman could expect to encounter approximately 3,000 sharks over a lifetime of daily fishing, based on the reef shark population density around the Gilbert Islands at that time.
3,000 sharks. That's a lot of dorsal fins.
I'm not sure if that's a fun fact or a warning.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review if you're so inclined. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.